laugh inwardly. Irene lifted a hand off the controls just long enough to give her fellow pilot a thumbs up, then returned her laser focus on the co-pilot's task of providing navigation data to Derek. She knew the heading they had the ship on was nearly perfect, and the instructor had nothing to complain about. Had nothing to do, because so far neither of the two humans had made any kind of significant mistake. Course within 97% of nominal, Irene could not help reporting. Oh, 98%. The humans ignoring her, defying her, made the cluster pissed off enough that she decided to deviate from the approved training course. With a tight smile at the trouble she was causing, she changed parameters of the simulation. Star Carrier reports Hardpoint 3 has a mechanical failure. Change course to Hardpoint 7. Without losing her cool or making a snarky remark, though she knew the hamster was screwing with them, Irene smoothly pulled the navigation control to the new guide beam and fed the data to Derek. Hardpoint 7 acknowledged. Watch your... That frigate will be crossing our heading, Irene warned as the instructor threw another complication at them. This one a ship that was coming into Hardpoint 6 and interfering with the toaster, although the larger and heavier training cruiser had the right of way. Adjusting course to keep clear. Taking power to 30%. Derek glanced toward Irene and she nodded. Slowing down to give that frigate a clear path to Platform 6, he said, just as the simulated frigate suffered an unlikely engineering failure and veered toward the toaster. This time, Derek could not keep the smile off his face. He had anticipated the instructor throwing a highly unlikely problem into the sim, and he was almost disappointed at how obvious and unimaginative the complication was. Taking power to 50%. Sound collision alarm. 50% is not authorized under proximity maneuver conditions, the cluster snapped gleefully, anticipating an opportunity to reprimand the primitive aliens. Reduce? The frigate has suffered an engineering fault of unknown severity and origin, Irene interrupted. Emergency flight regulations require us to get a safe distance as soon as possible in case the frigate's jump capacitors or reactor explode. With a grin, Derek reveled in the chance to truly fly the bulky cruiser, even if it was only in a sim. Bring in main power online, thrusters at 80%. The toaster's main normal space engines would soon be responding to his commands, surging the ship forward with awesome power. Main power ready, Irene reported. Releasing, pausing simulation, the cluster said unhappily. Resetting. That was... She cleared her throat. Acceptable. Our instruction course has not yet covered emergency flight regulations. Again, Derek turned in his couch to face the Ruhar, wiping the grin off his face. We studied those regs on our own before we came aboard the ship. We did not wish to waste your very valuable time, he added with a quick smile that he kept as genuine as he could. Hmph, Clasta Splun sniffed. For the next hour, she stuck to the standard training course, only throwing curveballs at them occasionally and only introducing approved complications. Chit-chat was kept to a minimum, and Irene was on her best behavior, knowing their success was the best way to piss off their alien instructor. After the toaster latched onto the Star Carrier, the Deal Me In had performed a series of jumps, then dropped off the training cruiser and other ships in dark interstellar space while the Giraptha went to pick up the other half of the battle group. Training had been suspended for 6 hours, as the toaster and the battle-damaged warships waited for the Giraptha Star Carrier to reappear and take them aboard. After 12 hours, with no sign of the Star Carrier, and with the warships busy patching up their stricken hulls and making repairs as best they could, the toaster resumed training on a limited schedule. Priority for pilot training in the simulators had been given to Ruhar cadets, as they would only be aboard the ship for another couple weeks before returning to the academy. So at first, Irene and Derek had been studying dull flight manuals by themselves, until Perkins asked why the ship's auxiliary control center could not be used to run simulations. With the cruiser hanging motionless in space, the AUX flight station was admittedly empty and unused, and all Perkins had to do was find an instructor who was willing to lower his or herself to training the most primitive semi-intelligent species in the known galaxy. Fortunately, instruction time partly counted toward qualified flight hours, so it was not impossible to persuade an instructor to take on 2 additional students. Unfortunately, since the best instructors were already busy, Irene and Derek had been stuck with the sour-faced Clasta Splun, who was predisposed to being grumpy because she knew no one else wanted to be trained by her. The Clasta was frustrated that the two humans had not quickly failed, which would have given her ample opportunity to insult them, and even better, would have allowed her to push at least one of them aside and use the simulator to build her own qualifying flight hours. More than 2 hours into the training session, she set a simple instruction to run and left the AUX control center to get a snack from the galley.
"That's a relief," Irene began to say before Derek raised a hand and silently pointed to the flight recorder module between the two pilot stations.
Whatever they said or did would certainly be scrutinized later by the Ruhar.
"Real, real challenge," she recovered.
"My turn?"
Derek pressed a button on his console and lifted hands away from the touchscreens.
"Your spacecraft."
The two pilots ran the simulation on their own, flying the starship through normal space to various points, until it almost became dull. Truly, flying even a light cruiser in normal space was not all that much different from flying a dropship. Flying in combat would be much more challenging. But they were far from enjoying that type of simulation. Several times Irene had to look to Derek, a huge grin on her face.
"Think about it. We are the first humans ever to fly a starship."
"Simulated," Derek reminded her, though that did not much tarnish their shared joy.
"It's simulated now," Irene agreed, knowing the standard training course would include actually moving the big cruiser some months in the future. "We were the first humans to ever fly a dropship for real."
"Ah, except for Captain Desai, when that guy Bishop stole it to do whatever they did. She was the first to fly a dodo that we know of."
"Fine, except for her," Irene admitted, wondering how the mysterious Desai had managed to fly a Ruhar dodo without any training.
Had Desai somehow gotten access to a simulator before she broke out of jail? No, it was more likely one of the whispered rumors was true. That the whole operation had been planned and run by the Ruhar, using Bishop's group of humans as a cover story. Unless the Ruhar clandestine operations people admitted the truth, no one would ever know. Irene looked at the clock on her console, feeling her back growing stiff from sitting so long in the pilot couch.
"Is our instructor ever coming back?"
The current sim program only had 10 more minutes remaining.
"This sim will end and repeat soon." Derek pointed to the loop indicator that was showing active.
"We could." Alarms blared and the simulation on their displays froze. Then the consoles switched to show real-time images.
"Hey, the Giraptha are back," Derek announced excitedly, recognizing the outline of the Deal Me In even though the displays and controls in front of them were now all in Ruhar common language script.
"Damn, I am glad to see those beetles again." He shot a guilty glance at the flight recorder module and decided to pretend he hadn't said anything noteworthy. They were aboard a Ruhar ship, and he knew the hamsters had their own nicknames for their Giraptha patrons. "Hands off," Irene lifted her fingers away from the controls, which should not respond to her anyway, as she did not have the proper access code or biometrics. Even if she did, the auxiliary control center needed to be authorized to have any effect on ship systems, and that authority could only be granted by the senior officers. When the ship was maneuvering, the AUX controls were supposed to be manned anyway, and Irene nervously looked toward the hatch for their instructor to return.
"Maybe we should get out of these seats."
"Oop," she added as artificial gravity began to fade. Cutting off gravity meant the ship could potentially be forming hard turns and accelerations. The display flashed to alert condition too.
"Where is the Clasta?"
"Regs say we remain in these seats until we are officially relieved," Derek pointed out, his tone reflecting his uncertainty.
"We're supposed to put our helmets on." He reached under his couch for the hard-shell helmet. "And button up."
"Derek, we are not pilots," Irene sighed and reached for her own helmet.
"Not yet."
She waved a hand at the consoles that were all showing the odd-looking Ruhar script.
"I can barely read this stuff."
"Me neither. But when Splun comes back, she will see we followed regulations to the letter and have nothing to bitch," he remembered the flight recorder was still active, "to reprimand us about."
"Okay,"
Irene agreed as her seat was the best place to watch the unfolding drama.
"Wow,"
she gulped as the ship suddenly slewed to one side, leaving butterflies in her stomach.
"Those ships are really moving.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm reading this right.
Derek squinted at a blinking notice from the toaster's bridge. But I think the Beatles ordered all ships to perform combat latching again. They must really be in a hurry to jump us out of here.
Derek. Irene figured out the controls for the sensors and zoomed the image in on the deal me in. Look at those ships attached to the star carrier.
Derek leaned over to watch her display before she mirrored the images on his console.
Woo, he whistled as he took in the view of battered and in some cases crippled warships.
There were only 4 Ruhar ships attached to the star carrier, but 7 ships had jumped into action. 3 ships were missing.
They were in one hell of a fight. Oh, damn, look at that. The star carrier took hits also.
He noted scorch marks and jagged holes in forward and aft hulls. Amidships, the spine had cables flopping around and pieces of the scaffolding bent or missing.
This is big effing trouble. Damn, who has the balls to hit the Giraptha?
Before Irene could respond, Derek's answer appeared in the form of a Bosphorok battlecruiser jumping in close.
Oh, shit.
Clasta Splun flailed her arms in a futile attempt to steer toward a handhold, missing as she flew by in the zero gravity. When the Giraptha star carrier jumped in unexpectedly and the alarm sounded, she had been finishing a snack and chatting with a cute senior cadet. She wasn't that much older than the cadet, she told herself. Why, she had graduated from the academy less than a year ago. Splun had been struck with guilty panic when the alarm sounded, knowing she was several minutes away from her human students, and without artificial gravity functioning, the trip back to the AUX control center would take longer. The AUX control center was not her action station when the ship was underway, but she knew the senior officers would rightfully fault her for leaving a pair of aliens alone in a vital part of the ship. When the gravity cut off, she had been racing headlong down a passageway and clumsily stumbled, sending herself awkwardly soaring through the air out of control. The passageway where she needed to turn left had gone past without her being able to catch a handhold, and her plight only got worse when she crashed into a trio of frightened cadets. The 4 of them struggled to separate, and the cadets got out of her way, helping her turn in the correct direction. No sooner had she launched herself across a side passage when the ship lurched, making her bounce off a bulkhead and bending a wrist painfully. The ship was already maneuvering, and no one was available to provide backup to the bridge helmsman. Splun finally hooked a foot painfully on a doorframe and halted her tumbling flight. With determination, she pulled herself along the correct passageway, seeing with dismay the 2 adult crewmen coming in from a side route. They were assigned to the AUX control center. And now she had no chance to get the aliens out of the seats before anyone saw they had been left alone. Wordlessly, she gave them a quick wave between handholds, trying to make clear they were all going to the same place. She slowed to avoid a collision, just as a Condition 1 alert sounded. The 3 of them stared at each other for a heart-stopping moment. Enemy ships had jumped in, or their own ship was about to jump into combat. No longer waiting for Splun, the 2 crewmen expertly pushed off hard with their legs, zipping down the passageway toward where the open hatch to the AUX control center could be partially seen. They almost made it. Splun saw no point to the 3 of them trying to jam through the hatch at the same time, so she gave her aching wrist a break and eased up slightly. She never saw the railgun dart that was moving at an appreciable percentage of light speed. The first dart of the pair slammed into the toaster's shields that were already weakened by hits from enemy masers, forcing the shields to absorb and dissipate gigajoules of energy. The second dart, hitting less than 2 meters from its companion, was also mostly deflected by the straining shields. Mostly. 8% of the dart managed to penetrate all the way through to the cruiser's hull, having been turned into plasma that burned its way through the ship's light armor like it was tissue paper. After punching through the armor with little trouble, the hellish globs of plasma burst in a cone-shaped fountain of death, burning and destroying everything in a 16-degree arc, and only stopping when they encountered the inner surface of the armor plating on the other side of the hull. 3 of the objects burned by the plasma jet were Splun and the 2 crewmen. Irene was startled not so much by the violent shaking of the ship as by the hatch behind them crashing closed. The quick automatic action of the hatch was not fast enough to prevent air being sucked out into the passageway, and Irene's flight suit inflated to compensate, with air hissing from a reserve tank in the helmet even before the visor could swing down. The flight suits they wore were based on combat skin suits, but were even less capable than flight suits used by crews aboard dropships and combat aircraft. When issued their new flight suits aboard the toaster, Irene and Derek had assumed the Ruhar fleet's thinking must be that if a ship were hit in deep space, a tougher flight suit was not going to be of much help. And Clasta Splun had not been wearing a flight suit at all, instead being dressed in the simple coveralls that were the standard crew uniform. Unless that hamster had been able to pause long enough to don an environment suit, she might already be dead.
Derek, incoming!
He watched transfixed in shock as missiles streaked in toward the toaster, with the forward section of the ship being pounded by repeated maser fire. Unknown to Derek, impact of the second railgun dart amidships had pushed the cruiser just far enough to avoid another pair of darts that bracketed the forward hull, with one barely striking the shields a glancing blow. As the two human pilots watched helplessly, their cruiser's point defense masers exploded one missile at a safe distance, then another. But damage from the railgun hit amidships had knocked out defense cannons and sensors in that section of the ship, leaving a gap in defense coverage. Recognizing their vulnerability, the command crew fired thrusters to roll the ship, exposing the undamaged defense cannons on the other side. Unfortunately, the enemy also adjusted to circumstances, and the incoming missiles arced around to aim at the damaged area. The missiles were faster and more nimble than the bulky old cruiser, so they had the advantage. Still, the defense masers kept pouring megajoules of energy at the missiles, and sheer numbers were on the side of the defense. 11 maser cannons against only 2 missiles. Technology was on the side of the missiles. The ship was Ruhar, while the missiles were manufactured by the advanced Bosphorak. With invisible maser bolts streaking past, the smart weapons rapidly changed course and speed, ejected decoys, and projected false images to fool Ruhar sensors. Derek's stomach tied in knots while he sat rigidly in the couch, wishing he could do something. Anything.
Yes!
He pumped a fist as one missile stumbled into a hail of maser beams and exploded. In its death, the missile had one last move to play, and it detonated its warhead in a shape charge directed forward at the cruiser. High-density warhead pellets traveling a quarter of light speed blasted the cruiser's energy shield, heating the degraded shield generators near the point of failure and lighting up that vulnerable area of shield like a beacon for the missile coming behind. As the last high-tech missile jinked sideways at 3,000 Gs toward the weakened shield, a nearby Ruhar destroyer exploded, its jump drive coils having been punctured by a pair of railgun darts from the enemy battlecruiser. To Derek's terror, the blast of high-energy photons and particles washing over the battle space blanked out the toaster's proximity sensors, and the cruiser lost track of the last missile for a crucial second. The missile, for all its advanced technology, also lost track of its quarry. But that was of little importance, for the missile knew the target's last position, and the big cruiser could not move far in a short time. Dropping all evasive maneuvers, the missile fired its engine for emergency thrust on a course that took it straight into the heart of where it knew the Ruhar ship had to be. Derek had no time to give voice to his terror, no time to shout a warning in case Irene had not seen the same data on her console. The Rue Tostella was tossed aside like a child's toy, spinning around so hard Derek's head hit the back of his helmet as the couch's restraint system automatically held the helmet steady to prevent him from snapping his neck. His brain rattled inside the shell of his skull. He struggled to make sense of simply who and where he was, the flickering displays in front of him forgotten.
Derek, you okay?
Derek coughed.
Shook up, he admitted.
In combat, he could not indulge in any macho bullshit. The other pilot needed to know he was not 100% right then.
You? Seeing double?
Irene blinked slowly to clear her vision so she could understand what she thought she saw on the ship's status display.
The front of the ship. Gone?
Derek instinctively wanted to shake his head. He also knew that more jarring was the last thing his brain needed right then. The ship was moving enough on its own, making the couch shake regularly with intermittent hard bumps. The shaking was probably caused by the ship's thrusters attempting to control the wild spinning of the ship, which was flipping on all three axes. Derek assumed the bumps were secondary explosions, a notion confirmed by new lights flaring on the ship's status display. Components were overloading and exploding all over the forward half of the hull. That is, the forward half of what was left, for a quarter of the ship's original hull was missing entirely.
Yeah, it's gone. Everything forward of frame 35 is just missing.
The sensors were showing an extensive debris field around and mostly in front of the cruiser, wreckage blasted away from the ship by an advanced technology warhead.
We're dead in the water.
He weakly lifted a hand to point to the status display, which showed half the defensive maser cannons were offline, and only half of those were even in a restart cycle. Shields were weak, and one shield, toward what was now the nose of the ship, was disconnected from a power source.
Why haven't the bird brains finished us?
Because we're just a training cruiser, Irene guessed.
Tapping the tactical display, she added,
They have more important targets.
Outside the ship, it was hell, with maser bolts, particle beams, and kinetic ordnance flying around thick and fast. The Bosphorak battlecruiser had already destroyed or disabled most of the Ruhar warships. The main fight now was between the Jarraptha and Bosphorak. The Beatles had their star carrier responding with every weapon they had, missiles ripple firing from launch tubes and masers burning continuously. But the superior strength of the enemy's heavier ship gave them an overwhelming advantage. Damaged Ruhar ships were ejecting from their hardpoints, adding their own weapons to the fight, knowing they had little chance for survival. Survival was not their goal, and escape was impossible, as the enemy had the battle space blanketed in a strong damping field. Two Ruhar destroyers were flying directly at the enemy ship on a collision course, hoping to ram the battlecruiser. Their suicide tactic was intended to provide a gap in the damping field, allowing the vital star carrier to get away. Alert to the danger, the Bosphorak were slamming the destroyers with concentrated railgun fire. One, then the other destroyer, was struck several times until their shields were entirely knocked out, exposing them to the comparatively weak maser bolts that seared deep into the noses of the destroyers, making the forward armor bubble and melt, opening holes for the maser energy to wreck the unprotected interiors of the ships. The first destroyer veered away, corrected back on course, then veered in the other direction, its engines offline, drifting uselessly away into deep space. The crew of the second destroyer, knowing it would be crippled and out of the fight before it could ram the enemy, activated a self-destruct mechanism to drop reactor containment. A half-second later, as the white-hot fusion plasma burst outward and contacted the fully charged banks of jump-drive capacitors, warheads of all missiles still in the ship's magazines detonated to add their energy to the maelstrom. The destroyer was replaced by a small, short-lived sun that expanded outward in a sphere, so only part of the wavefront washed over the enemy battlecruiser. And at such distance, the Bosphorak warship shrugged off the assault with only a minor fluctuation in damping field strength. With all Ruhar ships inside the damping field either destroyed or disabled, including the unimportant training cruiser near the edge of the field, the Bosphorak turned the full fury of their weapons on the hapless star carrier that was making a futile attempt to run away. Jarraptha star carriers had reinforced shielding and armor protecting the critical engineering components of the aft hull. Knowing that bit of tactical intel, the Bosphorak aimed masers, particle beams, railguns, and missiles just forward of the aft hull where it attached to the long spine of the ship. The only break in their focus on the star carrier was to direct two missiles at the training cruiser, to kill it, before its mostly aimless course took it beyond the reach of the damping field.
"We should jump," Derek advised.
As he spoke, more missiles launched from the enemy ship, two of them curving toward the toaster and accelerating hard. The inbound missiles were highlighted by blinking red symbols and red streaks projecting their courses. A pair of missiles were projected to impact the training cruiser, and point defenses were mostly showing as offline.
"Jump! We can't do anything. We're just running a sim."
"Oh. Yeah." Derek tapped his console where an alert was flashing that the simulation had been abruptly ended, and the auxiliary control center now had full authorization to maneuver the ship. Command authority automatically transferred to the auxiliary station when we lost the bridge, he declared, remembering that tidbit of info from the welcome aboard package they received when they'd been assigned to the cruiser. Derek never imagined he would need to remember such an obscure piece of trivia. We're the pilots now. Everyone aboard is counting on us. Irene turned to look at the hatch, hoping trained Ruhar crew would come in to relieve them. That, she saw with a shock, was not going to happen. The hatch had scorch marks on the inner surface, and the upper left corner appeared bent, bowed inward. Whatever had happened in the passageway outside, it must have been bad. Very bad.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, sure. Irene's mouth babbled as her mind caught up with the situation.
We've never performed a jump, or been trained in jump procedure.
We've both read the jump manual a dozen times or more.
Derek's voice was more squeaky than the soothing tone he tried to project.
We can do this.
If we can't,
he swallowed hard.
Well, the ship is dead anyway.
Right. Okay. Good.
Irene took deep breaths to psych herself up to do the impossible.
We're caught in the edge of a damping field, Irene noted,
even as her fingers called up the jump drive controls. She had only ever seen those controls on her laptop, not even in a simulator, and never for real.
Local damping field strength is a...
Reading Ruhar script was not her best skill.
32%?
She struggled to recall something she had read only once.
What's the safety limit for a successful jump?
28%, Derek stated.
Or was it 29? Or 38? Other than casually scanning a high-level briefing document about jump operations, he had no experience with the system.
We can't risk a jump.
The red thingies are getting closer to the green thingy.
Derek jabbed a finger at the display in front of him where red symbols for incoming missiles were homing in on the toaster.
We need to jump now.
If we jump inside a damping field, the drive could tear itself apart.
If we don't jump, those missiles will tear us apart. That star carrier is about to blow any second. It's getting hammered. We need to do it now.
What the hell, Irene told herself. Decision made. Can you find where the pre-programmed jump options list is? We can't program a jump by ourselves.
Even if a jump was programmed in the drive navigation system, would it be usable without adjusting for the damping effect? She did not know, and that was the problem. Derek peered at his console, touching unfamiliar controls.
I think this is it.
I think.
Yes, system shows 100% capacity, he noted.
That had to be the jump drive capacitors. The toaster had not jumped in days, so the capacitors would be fully charged. The ship rocked from multiple maser beam strikes, yellow lights on the display showing where the white-hot beams had burned through the defensive shields protecting the critical aft engineering section.
Select the second option and authorize it, she ordered,
as she tried to find the controls to release power from the capacitors into the jump coils. One thing she did know for certain was that the coils could not safely hold a charge for long. Once power began flowing from the capacitors, the coils needed to be used, or the power discharged quickly.
Why the second option?
Those Bosphorak knew where the star carrier was jumping to. We don't want to make our jump obvious by using the primary assembly zone option.
Ready?
She didn't need a reply, as she could see the second option on the list was now blinking blue.
5, 4, 3.
She reached out with her right hand to touch Derek, the jump now being on automatic. Derek took her hand, squeezed it, and turned to say something, when the ship violently skewed and shuddered as the Jarapa star carrier exploded. Then they jumped. Chapter 12.
Easy, ma'am. It's not a race, Dave cautioned as Perkins got her safety line snagged on a piece of debris protruding from a gaping hole in the ship's hull.
I'm fine, Chaika. You're not my babysitter.
No, ma'am. I do have more spacewalk time than you. Let me go first.
Why?
Perkins was predisposed to be irritated because of the dangerous situation, the lack of time, and the circuitous route they had to take toward the ship's engineering section, and because Sergeant Chaika acted like he needed to hold her hand the whole way.
Because you are younger and a man?
No, Colonel.
Because if one of us is expendable, it's not you. There's a whole lot of stuff attached to the hull that could kill us. He pointed to sparks arcing from another hole in the hull. Between here and that airlock. I should scout ahead. The sergeant's reply had chastened her. She had let impatience, anger, and fear overcome her need for cool judgment. Chaika, none of us are expendable. Not humans. Not out here. We don't know if anyone is left alive on Earth. UNEF on Paradise may be all that is left. Thank you. Go ahead and check for anything that might blow up in our faces, but be careful. Careful. You got that? I don't want to lose you, she added with a lump in her throat. Yes, Colonel. Dave's feeble grin could be seen in the faint lights illuminating his helmet faceplate. The ship had successfully jumped away from the battle space, or successfully enough, and the Bosphorok ship had not pursued. After a terrifying 15 minutes trapped in their designated section of the ship, not having any idea what was going on, as the comms system was offline, comms were partially restored, and Perkins had been able to use her command codes to get a rough and confusing status report. What she saw shocked her. The entire forward section of the ship was missing, simply gone, and the hull was breached in multiple areas. Main power was off. Even emergency backup systems were spotty and intermittent. Attempts to contact anyone in authority were a failure until Perkins located a feature that tracked the ship's officers. 1. There was only one adult crewman whose comm system indicated activity, and that person was several sections aft in the primary engineering control center. That was why Perkins and Chaika were in spacesuits clambering along the outside of the ship. Much of the ship's interior was a dangerously impassable shambles, with airtight doors closed and not responding to the codes Perkins had been given. She had quickly decided her best option was to travel aft on the ship's hull and enter the engineering center through an airlock, despite the danger. The ship shuddered occasionally, as one system or another overloaded and exploded, or pipes ruptured, or a thruster unhelpfully fired all by itself. To move at all required clipping a safety line, crawling along the hull using whatever handholds were available, and then clipping another safety line. They could not rely on the expedient tactic of floating between handholds, for the ship might suddenly jerk away beneath them and they would drift out to the end of the safety line, wasting precious time and exposing themselves to the jagged bits of debris surrounding the ship like a predatory cloud. It was a damned good thing, Perkins told herself, that the Toaster was a training ship. For the hull had regularly spaced handholds and attachment points for safety lines that would never be allowed on the exterior of a true warship. Got it, Dave announced as he hooked his boots into a clamp at the bottom of the airlock. Thank God it's active, ma'am. I'm starting the cycle now. Would it be best to wait for me to get there? No. Dave shook his head, though the gesture was barely visible in the blackness of interstellar space. Having the door open will give you more to grab onto. It's opening, he noted with great relief, swallowing his fear that the airlock might refuse to respond to a human. That airlock was intended for a single maintenance person, not groups of trainees, and it was a very tight fit for two people wearing spacesuits. Colonel, maybe I should wait outside while you cycle through. Screw that, Chaika. Get in here right now. I'm not risking this thing crapping out on us while you're out there. That's an order, she added when he hesitated. It was a tight fit, even a tight squeeze. They managed to stuff themselves into the airlock enough so no limbs stuck out to block the door sensors, and the outer door slid slowly closed. Chaika, Perkins grunted as his helmet pushed her head to the side at an awkward angle, and one of his knees was jammed into her crotch hard enough to make her left hip hurt. Unless you're gonna buy me dinner first. Oh, sorry. He tried moving his leg, but there wasn't much he could do about it. His right hand was free, so he used it to activate the emergency pressurization cycle, using a bottle of stored air to rapidly flood the lock with air. In moments, the inner door's locking pins retracted. Door's opening, he gasped as one of her elbows dug into his chest hard enough to leave a bruise. The engineering compartment holds air, he reported, as the pressure gauge read 92% of normal. Perkins got herself untangled from the sergeant and through the inner door first. Her hopes faded as her gaze took in the main compartment's condition.
Most displays were dark, with others flickering or displaying static or scrolling lines of gibberish. Without gravity, objects, both broken or merely loose, floated everywhere. A tool bounced off her helmet before she could see it coming. "Come on," she waved to Chaika without turning to look at him. Keeping a firm grip on handholds, she pulled herself across the compartment to where an injured Ruhar officer was loosely strapped to a table, surrounded by four cadets. As she approached, she reached up with a thumb to crack open her faceplate and swing it up, using her lips to pull the helmet microphone closer to her mouth. "Hello. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Perkins of the Human X-Force," she spoke slowly, carefully enunciating each word so the translator would not make unfortunate mistakes. A female cadet who had been literally hovering over the injured officer looked up, and Perkins recognized her as Jin Garner, a girl Nert liked very much.
"Colonel Perkins."
Jin turned toward the newcomers with an expression that was a mixture of fear and relief. The human colonel being a senior officer might take some of the responsibility off Jin's shoulders, but since Perkins was an alien, she was not likely to be of much use in the crisis.
"Urmat Datha is badly injured."
She put a hand over her mouth to contain her fear as the Urmat shuddered and blood bubbled from his lips. "We need to move him to the medical station." Perkins did not like the paleness of the officer's lips, nor the tiny bubbles of blood exhaled from his nose with every labored breath.
"We tried. We can't," Jin explained. "The passageways are all blocked. How did you get here?"
She looked toward the big door at the far end of the compartment, which still had its locking bars engaged to hold it shut.
"We spacewalked along the hull outside." "You did?"
Jin's eyebrows lifted, and again Perkins was struck by how some expressions were universal between species. Between bipedal species that walked upright, she reminded herself, and only those few species she had met.
"That is too dangerous. No more dangerous than being in here."
Perkins ducked and pushed away a broken piece of metal and composite that had floated in front of her face.
"Urmat Datha is the only survivor of the entire crew?"
She knew the Rue Tostella had departed Paradise with a limited number of adult crew, as senior cadets were expected to gain real shipboard experience by standing watches, performing routine maintenance, and other roles that would be filled by fully trained adult crew members. Losing the forward part of the ship had taken away the bridge and command crew with it. But how could the Urmat be the only survivor?
"We think so, yes."
Jin nodded a bit too vigorously, her fear evident.
"There were seven of us on duty here, with Urmat Datha in charge. Klasta Amatu and Cadet Sertil were killed."
She looked at the blackened mark on the hull.
"It's just us now. None of us are trained as medics. Are you?"
She looked to Dave, hopefully.
"Not in Ruhar physiology," Perkins frowned. "He needs the resources of a full medical station. His suit."
With one gentle hand, she wiped away some of the still wet blood on Datha's right side and did not like what she found. A rip. A tear wide enough that the suit's nano-repair mechanism was not able to close the fatal opening.
"Can we patch this?" "We used the patch kit for Cadet Sertil. That was Datha's order, but it did not save him."
Jin looked sadly to where the unlucky Sertil's body was strapped into a chair. Perkins could see at least three patches attached to that suit. She thought the patches had done their job, but Sertil had died anyway. Datha had probably thought he was being noble by telling the cadets to use the patches on a crew member more badly injured than himself, but Perkins knew that was the kind of amateur wishful thinking civilians indulged in. As the lone surviving adult officer, Datha should have known his duty was to have his own wounds tended to, so he could assist others. Now, everyone aboard the ship might all die, and there was nothing noble about that.
"The nanomachines,"
Jin glanced up to see if Perkins understood the translation.
"They worked to repair the suit, then after we blocked the air leak they pulled inside to stop Datha's blood loss."
"Your nanotech can work on mechanical and biological systems?" Perkins asked in surprise.
"No."
Jin reached up to wipe away the tears brimming in her eyes.
"The suit can inject medical nanobots into a user, and they did, but they needed help. The mechanical nano,"
the translator stumbled over the term,
As you said, it can only act to block blood vessels. It plugs leaks.
She looked up at Perkins, seeking understanding.
You did what you could. The Urmot needs skilled medical treatment. Is there another suit available?
No, there are no spares available now. The locker with spare suits was damaged. That is where Sertel was when he was hit.
Jin closed her eyes tightly, causing droplets of tear to float away from her face.
He can use my suit, she offered.
Perkins looked from Datha to the anxious cadet, judging their sizes.
I don't think he will fit.
He can use my suit, ma'am.
Dave began to pull off his helmet.
Forget it, Chaika. You know what it's like out there. You need to guide us back.
You.
She pointed to another cadet. You look about Datha's size. Get out of...
You.
Datha's eyes opened, and he reached up to grasp her forearm, missed, and his arm bounced off the table. Gently, Perkins caught his hand and wrapped her glove around his. The Ruhar officer tried to squeeze his hand, but his strength was gone.
Ship.
Badly damaged. The forward hull is missing.
Perkins did not sugarcoat the information.
We're on backup power, and that is failing. We have no shields, no propulsion, sensors are scrambled, and that Bosphorok battlecruiser could jump in on top of us at any second. Urmot Datha, you need to know right now that we believe you are the only adult crewman to survive.
Perkins told the truth without sugarcoating anything.
Datha was an adult, a crewman, an officer, with the rank of Urmot being equivalent to a major in the U.S. Army. The unvarnished truth is the least they owed to him.
Everyone else? Dead?
His words came out in a wet whisper, bubbles of blood choking him as he spoke.
Yes.
Perkins squeezed the man's hand. The dead crewmen were his shipmates, friends, people he might have served with for years. All gone now.
There are senior cadets who could assume...
No,
Datha declared with vehemence beyond his strength, and it threw him into a coughing fit, bubbles of blood spewing from his mouth onto the front of Perkins's suit. She did not flinch, merely held the Urmot's hand while he recovered.
You,
he pointed to Perkins with an index finger,
are an officer, senior officer. Your rank is equivalent to our Urmot.
He paused to take a breath. Perkins knew that was not quite true, as the rank structure of the Ruhar military was more complicated than the commissioned ranks of the U.S. Army. But the point was not relevant to the situation.
You must take command.
Me.
Perkins pointed to herself as all four Ruhar cadets sucked in sharp breaths.
Urmot Datha, I am not Ruhar. I am an alien.
Surely a senior cadet,
he coughed,
is not an officer. Trainee. You.
He scrunched up his eyes as a wave of pain struck him.
Have experience. Combat experience. You take command.
Perkins looked at Chaika, both of them stunned. With his other hand, Datha pawed for the Z-phone on his belt. Jin pulled it out and put it into his free hand as Perkins released the hand she had been holding. With both of his hands so shaky and weak, he needed Jin to steady the phone. He pressed buttons, and a command application popped up on the screen. Datha spoke quietly into the phone.
Urmot Farpu Datha, transferring command of the warship Ruh to Stella, to Lieutenant Colonel.
He looked up to see if his pronunciation was correct.
Emily Perkins, of the Human Expeditionary Force.
Transfer of command acknowledged. A mechanical voice issued from his phone at the same time Perkins's own phone beeped and vibrated. She looked at her phone, seeing a cascade of command authorizations scrolling past. They were all in Ruhar script. She could barely read half of the words.
How the hell could she?
Just then, her phone must have realized she needed to read English, for all the commands blinked, and the words were then recognizable. She was in command of a Ruhar warship? No. She was in command of a battered hulk that was leaking air and had no source of power, with a crew of frightened cadets in deep interstellar space that was now a war zone.
I accept command.
She saluted Datha, using the two fingers to her cheek gesture of the Ruhar.
Until you are able to return to duty. Sergeant Chaika, take two cadets with you and get Urmat Datha to the medical station. First priority is to restore main, or at least auxiliary power. Her fuzzy recollection of the ship's systems was that auxiliary power was a sort of fuel cell that did not have enough output to run more than basic systems, and a fuel cell needed a fuel tank. With the hull so peppered with breaches that it looked like Swiss cheese, did she dare hope a fuel tank had survived unscathed?
Cadet Garner, who is the senior engineering cadet?
Sath Kallan, but I have not been able to contact her. She was...
Jin's lower lip quivered.
Her duty station was in the forward section of the ship.
Perkins knew she had asked the wrong question.
Who is the senior engineering cadet right here, right now?
That is me.
Jin swallowed, her incisors sticking out over her lower lip.
Urmat Perkins, I am not qualified.
You are as qualified as anyone available. Sergeant Chaika, when you get forward, pass the word for engineering cadets to make their way aft. We need all the help here we can get.
Urmat, I barely know.
Senior Cadet Garner, I know nothing about these systems. She waved a hand to encompass the shattered equipment around them. We are in interstellar space, without power, and with a Bosphorak battlecruiser probably hunting us. If we can't restore power, we are dead. Is that clear? You cadets came aboard the... She almost referred to the ship as Toaster, which now seemed inappropriate. The route to Stella to gain real-life experience. Think of this, Perkins forced a smile she didn't feel, as a problem added to a training simulation.
A problem in a training sim. Right.
Jin bit her lip as she thought. A sim. Yes, she could think of the disaster as a particularly challenging and outrageously, ridiculously, unfairly challenging test in a sim. That way she could push the very likely possibility of impending death to the back of her mind and concentrate on the problem.
Right.
She looked up at the other three cadets.
Prance, you are with me.
While two cadets got the now unconscious Datha out of his useless suit, Dave pulled Perkins aside.
Ma'am, maybe you should go with the Urmat.
No, Sergeant, I need to be here.
Priority one is restoring power, or this ship is nothing but a composite tube that will be getting cold soon. If Garner needs my command codes to reactivate a system, she waved her phone, I need to be here. Right now, this is the heart of the ship. The rest of the hull is just dead weight without the reactors. A few minutes after Dave went out through the airlock with the injured Datha and a cadet, Perkins was playing with the new command features of her Z-phone when she found a way to track the life signs of everyone aboard. It was also a way to compare the life signs against the crew roster, giving her an unwelcome confirmation of how many Ruhar were dead, including all of the adult crew other than Datha. 24 Ruhar cadets were also among the dead, including the senior engineering cadet. After giving her a sense of the damage that made her feel sick, the list then made her heart soar. Irene and Derek's life signs were strong and inert. The young hamster was doing well except for an elevated heart rate, which was expected under the circumstances. She clicked on the icon for Captain Strebich, and a comm channel opened.
Captain Strebich.
Colonel Perkins. Oh, it is good to hear from you, ma'am.
Irene's voice trembled with relief.
We are in the auxiliary control center. We're kind of trapped here.
The Ruhar can't get you out?
We're alone, ma'am. There's vacuum outside the hatch. I think we have a slow leak in here somewhere. My ears have been popping, and it's getting harder to breathe. We have flight suits and helmets, so we can go on internal oxygen when we have to.
You and Bonsu are alone?
Then,
she thought back. The nose of the Toaster had been blown away several minutes before the ship jumped away from the battle space.
Who jumped the ship?
Well, that was us, ma'am. We did the best we could. I don't think we had a choice at the time. We were tracking two missiles running straight at us. Our shields were knocked back, and the proximity sensors could barely see anything.
When did the two of you get trained on jump procedures?
We, kinda didn't, Perkins heard Derek join the conversation, and Irene put her phone on speaker.
We had to wing it based on training briefs we studied. Ma'am, it was either risk the jump drive blowing up in our faces or let those missiles kill us for certain. I figured if the drive coils blew, that would at least confuse enemy sensors for a while, maybe help the star carrier get away.
That was a ballsy call, you two.
A good call.
Colonel? The rest of the team? Irene asked anxiously.
They're all fine. And Nert, he's fine too. The Ruhar crew? They're not so good. Well, the entire crew is dead except for one badly wounded engineering officer.
All of the crew?
Derek's tone was shocked.
Oh, shit. The cadets are in charge now?
No, Bonsu. I am.
Sorry, ma'am. What did you say?
The injured officer transferred command authority to me.
They can do that?
We're aliens to them, Derek mused aloud.
Apparently they can, Perkins said without humor. Right now I've got cadets trying to get the reactor restarted. That tells you our situation. We're dead in the water, and that Bosphorok battlecruiser might jump our asses before we know it.
Ma'am, I don't think that's very likely, Irene stated hopefully. We made a bad jump, really dirty, because we caught the edge of the damping field, so the resonance of our jump field must have been really chaotic, and the battle space was full of high-energy particles and spatial distortion. I don't think that enemy ship could track our jump endpoint. Not easily.
Christ, Strebich. That's the first good news I've heard all day. We may be safe because we screwed up the jump?
Colonel, right now, even we have no idea where we jumped to, Derek admitted. Until we get the nav system back online, we're blind. Although, the wheels in his head began spinning with an idea. We could launch a dropship, if any of them are still spaceworthy. Their nav gear will fix our position for us.
A dropship's sensors can establish our position with enough accuracy for us to program a jump? Perkins asked hopefully, before realizing she had gotten ahead of herself.
Oh, forget it. We can't jump anyway without the reactors.
That's not true, ma'am, Irene reported, cringing as she looked at Derek, who was worried she had gotten their CO's hopes up for nothing.
The reactors provide juice to jump drive capacitors, but our capacitor banks still have a 72% charge. We're good for another jump, except we don't know where we are, and the drive control system is offline.
And we have no idea how to program a jump, Derek added helpfully.
Sorry, ma'am.
That's all right, Bonsu. I sure as hell don't need people trying to put a good spin on things for me.
The two of you will be all right in there for a while?
Affirmative, Irene replied, with her voice sounding distinctly unhappy.
We are sure you have other priorities.
You got that right. I'll see if a cadet crew can get you out of there, but we need pilots anyway, and that AUX station is the only place the ship can be flown from?
It is, Irene agreed.
Then sit tight.
Strebich? Bonsu? I can't tell you how good it is to hear you're both still with us.
Perkins had no sooner ended the call when Dave pinged her.
Colonel, we have a problem. I think Datha is dead. He's not responding at all now, and the pulse indicator on his wrist pad is reading zero. It could be a glitch, but I shined a light in his faceplate, and it looks like he's not breathing.
Shit. She clicked the icon for Datha on her phone, and it showed his life signs had ceased.
Where are you?
Still outside the ship, about halfway. We had to take a different route. Looks like a power relay under the hull blew after you and I went past. It's arcing real bad.
Perkins paused to think, though Cadet Garner was waving for her attention.
Chaika, keep going. Datha may still be alive and we've got to try to save him. Ruhar can go longer without oxygen than we can, and we need you to round up engineering cadets to send back here. Oh, also,
she tried to snap her fingers, but the suit gloves muffled the sound.
See if you can find a route back here that stays inside the ship. There must be some passageways that aren't blocked.
Well, obstructions aren't the only problem, ma'am. A lot of the interior is exposed to vacuum, or there's power relays blowing.
Yeah. We'll need to get a crew working on disconnecting relays and plugging holes. I'll have Jared and Coulter organize something.
Damn it. What else did she need to think about before a disaster overwhelmed them?
She turned her focus back to the immediate engineering problem.
Garner, what is it?
Ormat Datha indeed had died while being transported to the medical station, which anyway had no qualified doctor to assist the many wounded, and the medical bot was operating on reduced capacity. Irene and Derek had been strapped into pilot couches, and the other Mavericks had dutifully secured themselves into their beds when the maneuvering alarm sounded. The cadets did not have the luxury of strapping in and waiting. Most of them had designated action stations, so many had been moving through the ship when it got hit. A dozen young people had been killed or severely injured when the ship lost its nose, because they hadn't yet reached their action stations. Others were lost when masers or railguns or missiles tore open their section of the ship. Emily Perkins considered it ironic that the uselessness of humans aboard an alien ship is what had saved their lives. She also considered that a training ship full of teenage cadets had no business being dragged into action with a real battle group. If it had been her decision, she would have jumped the Star Carrier to a safe location and dropped off the route to Stella before taking the battle group into harm's way. As it had not been her decision, she needed to focus on what she could affect right then. Jin Garner was overwhelmed with the task of first stabilizing backup power, then trying to determine if it was safe to restart the reactor. She begged Perkins for more cadets who specialized in the engineering field, particularly power generation systems. It was time for Perkins to speak to the cadets, to speak to the crew, she reminded herself, for cadets were the only crew the ship had. How to do that? She fumbled with her phone, not wanting to distract Jin from her work, and not wanting to show how unfamiliar she was with basic ship systems. Okay, there it is. She found after 4 minutes of almost random clicking around the screens. The entire communications system was not offline due to lack of power. It had been simply disabled and needed to be rebooted. Her command codes allowed Perkins to call individual people, but otherwise comms were squelched. That was, she vaguely recalled, standard procedure in combat when a ship's stealth field was inactive. Internal comms posed a risk of electromagnetic radiation leaking beyond the ship and betraying it to enemy sensors. That procedure was great in most conditions, but while outside the ship, Perkins had seen so many power conduits arcing that the ship was lit up like a Christmas tree. She found the codes to re-enable the ship-wide comm system, took a breath, and spoke to the crew. Her crew. Attention all hands. This is Lieutenant Colonel Perkins. Chapter 13. That is all, said the voice of the alien, and Biffed stared in utter astonishment at the speaker in the wall panel. The alien had spoken in heavily accented Ruhar, but instead of appreciating the endless hours of effort she had devoted to mastering a completely foreign language, Biffed was insulted by how her primitive tongue butchered the words. An alien? In command of our ship? Biffed raged, spitting in his fury. Perkins was not only an alien. She was from a backward species that barely had spaceflight when the Ruhar arrived at their disgusting planet. A species that had come to Gitanu as an enemy occupation force, and only recently had renounced their allegiance to the Kristang Coalition. As natural-born cowards, the humans would switch sides again as soon as it was convenient, Biff declared. This Perkins woman had only been aboard the route to Stella for a month. How could she possibly be so insufferably arrogant to think she was qualified to command a Ruhar cruiser, a ship where every piece of technology was far beyond her understanding? Biff raged and railed against the injustice to the point of battering an innocent wall panel with a wrench. The action only caused a scratch on the panel and sent Biff spinning off across the compartment out of control in the zero gravity, injuring his dignity. His companions did their best to quell their leader's spiteful temper. They assured him that Ormat Datha must not have known Biff was alive when command was transferred to the alien, or the alien had somehow coerced Datha. It was well known the humans were desperate for recognition, desperate for any opportunity to show they could be equal to the clearly superior Ruhar. Biffed should be in command. Only he could save them. Was that not why Biffed already commanded the cadet corps aboard the ship? After soaking up enough praise to soothe his outraged ego, Biffed made an angry cutting motion with one hand to end the babbling of his underlings.
Datha was injured and not competent to transfer command. He was a good man. A good officer. But he had no authority to give this warship
he emphasized that word. To an alien. A first-year cadet, he thought of the traitorous nerd. Knows more about this ship than the human Perkins does. Do you know she was a staff assistant, not a line officer?
His friends nodded vigorous agreement, pleased that Biff was back to his old self.
This ship is disabled in deep space, on our own. Life support is failing. The reactors are offline. Backup power will be strained by